Hey, everybody. Welcome to this week's OIG Roundtable. Wade and I got the memo. We at least knew to wear something with advice. Matt is getting ready, apparently, to go to the Caribbean. He's wearing his summertime peach flamingos.
It's my shark shirt.
Yeah, your shark shirt. All right, whatever. Well, you are a shark. You're a shark in the waters of
my
healthcare.
It's my business development shirt.
Yeah, exactly. So we're back for another great week here, always, with my two compadres. Wade McFall, retired assistant special agent in charge from the LA field office, one of our managers on our SO investigative team, and Matt Kachansky, our payment integrity director here, retired Northeast UPIC director and retired special agent in charge from OIG. I am still Eric Rubenstein, senior director of litigation, fraud, waste, and abuse here. So today we want to talk about the other big case that just recently came out of Arizona, $1.2 billion skin grafts. And we'll talk a little bit more about it. And, you know, this kind of is a parlay off of the recent case that was out there, the $2 billion catheter case. So these cases, while not the same, obviously the dollar amounts are similar. And obviously the short term, the fraud on the $2 billion case was a few months. And this one was just about a year or so, maybe a little bit more. But obviously very big cases, very big dollar amounts. And, you know, the big question that everybody has been circulating around on social media, particularly LinkedIn, if you're reading articles about it, is this whole premise of why. Why is it that $1.2 billion in fraud occurs? Why is it that $2 billion in fraud occurs? And, you know, kind of the overarching prevailing discussion of in the DME space, catheters and urinary incontinence supplies are well-known fraud areas. And in this $1.2 billion case, which involved wound grafting kits, are known areas of fraud. So this is not a surprise. When we see these cases and we read these press releases, nobody in our space is shocked, awed, amazed. We just look at it and we go, another example of where the fraudsters found a way to kind of beat the system. The overarching facts are that nurse practitioners were involved, $200-300 million in kickbacks were paid, a couple of shell consulting companies were out there with the sales reps that were connected up to the manufacturers. At the end of the day, some billing guidelines were put out there by the manufacturers. We all know you should not rely on those. Kickbacks paid out to the nurse practitioners. Instances where the medical professionals, meaning the nurse practitioners, were being told to override their actual medical decision-making, wounds that were already healed, wounds that were infected, wounds that would otherwise not be treated by these wound grafts. So it kind of hits all of the things that we look at and scratch our heads. And Wade, I want to start with you, because one of the things that, you know, you always do when you look at these press releases, you do some of the more esoteric analyses. You know, when we talked about that one case involving the hospital and the billing code issue, you went right on and you looked up the four columns of the type of bill and some of those esoteric. This is like investigator 101. Like, what are the kind of esoteric things? And one of the things that you noted was that these skin graft, these wound kits are done by measurement and are paid out by the measurement. And the one thing that we were just talking about is when I was at OIG, we did a case. It was a Medicaid case. It involved a doctor who was suturing wounds on infants. He was a pediatrician. And all of the kids that he was sewing wounds up for had wounds that were like 8, 12, 14 inches long on their faces, which is bizarre because the last time I checked, I don't know if I ever saw an infant or a toddler that had a face that was that big. A 12-inch wound is probably like the equivalent length of cracking open an adult's chest post-cardiac surgery. So, you know, these kinds of things where like the size of the wound is going to be a total non sequitur. And then typically when you've got it, and in this case, it's the same kind of group of nurses, nurse practitioners, right, that were all being paid, like, you know, the craziness. But you made some kind of funny, not ha-ha, but funny, pathetic observations about kind of the cost versus the size versus the measurements and, like, huge red flags.
Yeah, there's one of the first things that I found interesting reading parts of the indictment is one of the subjects, Alexandra, I don't know how to say her last name, Gerke, I guess, but she was telling the nurse practitioners, who, by the way, are paid a flat rate per encounter, they get between $500 and $1,000 every time they see a member and they apply one of these grafts or bandages. So, you know, look at that as kind of a kickback situation. But anyway, she's talking about the size of the grafts, and she told them, if it's the size of half the size of my pinky finger, and she's, you know, of course showing them, she says, I still want the minimum size you should order is a 4x6. So that's like, you know, 4x6 photograph, a postcard size. Right. And the wholesaler charges $1,000 per square centimeter. So a 4x6, you know, graph is $155,000. And they're, you know, arguably they have more than one wound. So if they're making them order the larger ones, I'm sure they're not cutting them like you and I would do. If we're paying that out of our pocket, you're going to make it a size that's reasonable. So they're probably ordering multiple, you know, allografts per member. So that brings up another thing that we look at is $155,000 or maybe $300,000+ for these grafts. Hopefully, and again, these are members or beneficiaries who are probably not in the best health if they have these types of wounds. So they're not, you know, picking up their mail and looking at their Medicare EOMBs, you know, to see what was billed. But hopefully somebody, either a family member or a caretaker, is doing that, because that should be a red flag if you have somewhere between $155,000, maybe $300,000, $400,000 for these grafts. It's like the new phrase is "see something, say something." It's like you should be calling somebody, you know, the Medicare hotline, 1-800 HHS tip, something like that, because that's a crazy amount of money. And I get that they're able to charge a lot because of the makeup of them. That's based on the active ingredient is placental cells. So granted, it's going to be more than a typical graft, but that's a huge amount of money. So when they're building these types of things, I would hope that part of the bringing it to the government's attention was people looking at their Medicare, you know, EOMBs or CHAMP, you know, the VA. There was a bunch of, it wasn't just Medicare,
right?
But everybody gets some type of, you know, explanation of benefits.
You bring up two things that I want to touch on before we move on. And the first one is that the documents that you read reflected that they were telling the nurse practitioners what to do, right? Right. Which means that at some point there probably was a cooperating witness, right? Because that would be a conversation that would have been held behind closed doors where someone's being instructed. So that leads me to believe, we don't know this because we don't have that kind of information, but that it leads me to believe that there likely was a cooperating witness. Because when you have a case like this where there's kickbacks, the big thing in a kickback case is that someone's got to tell on themselves. Right. And so it kind of begs the question of at some point, did they flip one of these nurse practitioners, and did one of those nurse practitioners or someone else wear a recording device where they got this on, audio, video, or both, versus just the he said, she said? Because, you know, typically, right, on these kind of instances, you don't want a he said, she said. You know, they told me that even if it's pinky size to do this or do that, you kind of want to stay away from that. But the other piece of it is this whole premise of looking at the explanation of Medicare benefits, EOMBs, or in the commercial world, it's called explanation of benefits, EOBs, and the fact that they're the inherent challenges of, even if you had the EOMB in front of you, and we've all looked at them, and they're hard for us to understand. They're hard for people who know this space. And so, you know, it kind of always begs the question of, if EOMBs or EOBs, as in the commercial space, were more layman, would that have made a change? And I think, you know, that's a question that remains kind of more rhetorical, because, you know, when you're dealing with an elderly population of people with comorbidities, they're going to the doctors multiple times a week. Does anybody even read them? Particularly when you have people who have a secondary insurance, or people who have Medicaid, or there's a waiver of a copay. You know, my favorite cases were those cases where there was no additional copay, either because it was being waived or secondary insurance, where the patient would say, why do I care? It's free. when it's really not. So yeah. A couple of those things, Wade, you know, before we go on to Matt, like these are, you know, the telling on yourself in a kickback case, important piece, but also the one that kind of always stands out is why aren't explanation of benefit forms easier to understand? And the challenges of being able to ferret out fraud, right? We always at, right? We talked to Gene Stone, right? We just did a LinkedIn Live. We talked about senior Medicare patrol. You've worked with them. Matt and I have worked with them. The question is, it's like you can do all of these things and have 1-800-HHS tips. But if people don't understand the thing that they're looking at, all of these collateral pieces of the puzzle become entirely moot.
Yeah, but I think in this case, I would hope it would be a little bit different just because of the amount that's being paid. I can see, you know, that happening 99% of the time where someone looks at their explanation of benefits and there's some weird charges, but it's, you know, $75 here, maybe $100 there, different amounts. And you kind of look at it and say, well, I don't know. I don't know what these codes are. But when you get a bill that, you know, it's several thousand, $100,000, you know, even at several $100,000, I would hope that would be alarming enough to call, you know, the senior Medicare patrol or HHS tips, whatever. I would think that would bring it to a different kind of alertness level because it's such a high dollar amount. Maybe that's not the case. But also I was going to bring up, you were saying that there was some other party involved, maybe a cooperating witness. I couldn't tell from reading the indictment or parts of the indictment, but they did refer to the wholesaler as not by name. So I don't know if that somehow, you know, that not to read into that too much, but they're not throwing them out as part of a conspiracy. So that might have been one angle right. on it.
Right. And I'm just, this is just us talking, right? But, you know, right. typically in a healthcare fraud case where there's kickbacks, a part of that case, you know, the only way that you know that there are kickbacks is if that happens. I mean, obviously, if the nurse practitioners were being paid a flat fee per, you can go in and from a data perspective, you could say, okay, this nurse practitioner, if they got paid all of this money and it's not cash, you know, and they're being considered consultants or whatever they're doing, and you're seeing they did 100 of these grafts and this is the amount of money they got, and they got, you know, you can kind of work the back end and see it. Where there's a quid pro quo, you know, one of the things that's out there that I encourage people to look at is I encourage people to go look at the Gerber, G-E-R-B-E-R case. That's a case out of the Third Circuit Court of Appeals. And Second Circuit just adopted the Third Circuit's position. In the Gerber case, they call it the one purpose test. And that means that if one purpose of a payment is to induce a referral, or if one purpose of that payment is the quid pro quo, you have violated the anti-kickback statute. For whatever reason, a lot of other districts have kind of danced around the issue, but the Second Circuit has adopted what the Third Circuit says. So it's kind of what's that quid pro quo. So Matt, excuse me, let's talk about kind of the obviousness of this. The one thing that we always talk about is the inherent flaw in that 12-month submission of a claim from the provider, and then also just kind of the overt part of $1.2 billion in 4x6 wound care kits. Who's sleeping here?
Right, right. Yeah, got to go back to the whole premise of insurance. It's based on trust. But the members or the beneficiaries, the patients, trust their providers. Maybe that's why they don't read the EOMBs as closely as they should, other than the fact that they're very complex. And I think Medicare gets them once a month now, and it's like could be a laundry list of things. But it's based on trust. The other trust is the plans trust their providers to bill them appropriately. You know, they build in certain edits and things like that, but it's based on trust. You know, they don't check every claim before it comes in. It's just automatically paid. But here, that trust should have been a little questioned early on when you've got a huge spike in this type of care where the criteria for the use of those types of wound care kits is very high. All of a sudden, they're getting the largest ones for every patient for these two nurse practitioners. That should have triggered something in the edit system to say, hey, this is what, there's something going wrong here.
Right. Meaning, what are the chances?
What are the chances of all this is happening right now?
What are the chances of every patient being seen by nurse practitioner Smith, that every single patient that needs a wound kit needs 4x6? They all have wounds that are all of similar, like, what are the chances of that? Like, and we're not talking, by the way, that these nurse, we have no information to suggest either way, but I would be amazed if any of these nurse practitioners, are they tip of the spear wound experts, right? Are they wound care experts, and are they at the tip of the spear where every single patient within whatever that radius is are being referred to these particular docs or these particular nurse practitioners?
Yeah, it's there's just the pattern there is so clear that it should have been caught early on. And the other, you know, the other issue that I see is we know DME is a problem. There's a higher error rate with DME than any other specialty. Yeah. One of the things we always see is, and we're going back to this 12-month thing, is, you know, these equipments and wound care kits and things are being supplied to patients that are being ordered by providers that have no history, at least in the billing system, with those patients. You know, why is it that a plan, Medicare, Medicaid, a commercial plan, can't simply deny those or hold those until a bill comes in from the referring physician saying that they, you know, they had an E&M or they did something that they were able to diagnose that the patient needed this thing? But when I was with the UPIC, we raised this continually with CMS, and they would go back to can't do it because of the 12-month rule, where the provider has 12 months to send it in, and so we have to let these payments go. We can't hold them for 12 months. And I was like, but you know that 99% of these, especially in these DME, when we were dealing with, you know, the orthotics kits and the genetic testing and all of these things, that they're fraudulent. Still, they would not do it based on that 12-month rule of the provider being allowed to send in the claim 12 months after the service. And it's just a frustrating hurdle that you could never get over. I mean, these funds could have been stopped up front had they just done away with that type of administrative thought process.
You know, the thing that's interesting, Matt, is that the 12-month rule has been in effect since 2011, I think. It used to be 18 months, and if you submitted the claim after 12 months, you were subject to a reduced reimbursement rate. You had a penalty. Right. And so providers would sometimes play the game. You know, I had a very large podiatry fraud case where the provider intentionally submitted claims after 12 months because he wanted to blur his fraud scheme. And so he was intentionally submitting claims that were untimely and was willing to take the hit for that. That 12-month rule, which, by the way, is a codified rule, for CMS to change it, it's going to require, it's a legislative piece, which means that it is a policy, which means that it's subject to the 60-day comment period before it's closed, and then the policy changes. And I know, you know, I think we have spoken about it until we have been blue in the lips about the fact that we know that this is one of the ways that the unscrupulous providers are getting, you know, around this. But it still kind of begs the question of either creating, you know, kind of an NCCI edit or an MUE edit, you know, that if a patient needs this graft and they haven't been to a wound specialist, they haven't been to a doctor where their diagnosis has been, you know, diabetic neuropathy with wounds, or, you know, that an ICD-10 for a wound didn't appear in the past 6 months, and all of a sudden, like, boom, this appears, right? It's like, how does this even, you know, how does this even happen? It's in that same vein. And I say this jokingly, but I mean it kind of in a satiric, sad way. When you see these DME providers providing bilateral knee braces to double amputees or single amputees, or you get a knee brace for the right knee and you don't have a right knee because you're an above knee amputee, you know, something like that. Or, you know, how is it that people are getting these kind of things when they don't have the limb doesn't exist.
Right. Yeah. And with these, you know, these types of wound care kits, there are certain things that had to have been tried and failed before you use this type of very expensive wound kit.
Where are the policy fillings for those? Policy piece, right? Yeah. Key policy piece. The wound care is not the first line of defense.
Right. So is there billing in that patient's history for the things that should have been done first? If not, deny. But they're not doing that.
Right. And these become things that become from a plan edit perspective, like, you know, whether it's Medicare, Medicaid, you can kind of see this. You know, we talk all the time about historical information can really help you with shaping what goes on, you know, forward and seeing that. When you start to see an instance where a bunch of patients are getting these wound care kits and there's nothing in their history, it's similar to the, you know, in the DME, somebody gets a knee brace and they have no history of having osteoarthritis or anything like that. Like, where does this all, you know, where does this all come from? It kind of, you know, kind of begs that question. It's, you know, like, let's stay awake for 8 hours and figure this out. Like, and I think it all gets back, and Wade, I want to go to you. Last piece, as we wrap up, it all gets back to good vetting of cases, good analytics at the front end, and the importance, right? Auditors, investigators, and analysts need to be in the same room having the same conversation. You can't be, right? You can't be in a vacuum. Wade McFall cannot be successful if he never speaks to an auditor or speaks to someone regarding data.
Right. And I think it goes back to the vetting of the cases too, where we talk about different cases that take precedence over others. And again, like, patient harm is always at the top of the list. But when you have numbers like this, that should get not only your attention, but your partners in the audit department and the data department. It's like all hands on deck when you have this kind of a law or potential loss. You just can't afford not to address this, you know, quickly.
Right. And this also gets to the last piece, which is the fact that this case included Medicare, Medicaid, commercial, Champus, TRICARE. This also kind of then gets back to, Wade, the simple premise of speaking to people from other organizations, being part of groups where you can have this information sharing, and, you know, maybe having that law enforcement liaison to have these kind of conversations, information sharing sessions. You can't fight this battle on your own, right? This has to be a team approach, whether it be internal, external, or combinations of the two.
Yeah, and a lot of times, you know, we would get cases that were strictly Medicare or Medicaid and Medicare, but it was I don't want to say rare, but we oftentimes didn't have cases that involved VA, Champus, and frankly, we didn't work a lot of cases with private insurance either. But having the healthcare fraud task force meetings, you know, monthly, quarterly, whatever they are, they're invaluable for having this type of thing where, you know, towards the end of the meeting, everybody kind of throws up, hey, you know, I have this case, kind of to test the waters with the other partners to see if they're seeing the same thing. Throw the name up there. Maybe they weren't aware of it, but they can go back and run it and say, oh, we're getting hit pretty hard on this too. So those meetings are important. And then the, like you say, the law enforcement liaison to kind of bridge the members from the task force meeting with the private insurance that doesn't have the law enforcement connections. It's like the most important part to uncover these kind of multi-agency, multi-insurance company massive frauds.
Yeah, I mean, you know, as I always said, when Matt was running the Northeast UPIC, I saw him more than I saw many of my coworkers, because Matt spent a lot of time in the region. I know he was on the road because Northeast region, the UPIC is, you know, Maine to Virginia, basically. And, you know, we would see Matt easily a couple of times a year, if not more, for these kind of meetings where you have to have these, you know, you have to get together and have these discussions to understand, you know, what's out there. So it's just part of that vigilance. That's, you know, that's part of it. So you got to read these press releases. I mean, that's what it comes down to, because if you're not reading these press releases of what's out there, you know, we talk about it all the time. We talk about, we do training for SIUs. We talk about it on these podcasts, is that these press releases become sources of intelligence gathering for you as an SIU team to go and find cases, mine cases, but also, you know, are you spending your time working a bunch of small dollar cases? Is it, you know, is it SIU death by a thousand paper cuts? Or are you really targeting some of these high dollar cases? Are you flagging high dollar reimbursements immediately? Are you flagging it as a questionable claim? Because we should not be seeing billions of dollars in skin allografts. It just shouldn't happen, particularly when it's to a segmented group of referring providers. Like that should be, that doesn't pass the stink test. So, you know, you got to get this together. And I get it. This wasn't just Medicare. It wasn't just Medicaid. And what we don't know is in the individuality of it, what was the dollar amount that was there? But we're only talking about three or four organizations. We're not talking about, you know, 50 payers to make up that $1.2 billion, where it is like a death by a thousand paper cuts. We're talking about a limited number of payers out there. So that's part of why that interaction between organizations, whether it's SIUs or whether it's on the government, becomes an important piece of this. So yet another big case at the OIG. You know, basically within a 12-month period, we've now seen, you know, $3.2 billion. And as most people understand, you know, you're not getting dollar for dollar on that, right? The $1.2 billion, the people that were the tip of the spear on this are, you know, that some of that money's been spent and it's just gone, wherever it may be. So, you know, that's why this pay and chase methodology that we have to just be, we have to just be better at it. Pay and chase is kind of the way we operate as a country. We just have to be better at it. And we can be better at it. So, and we'll keep talking about it, which hopefully the people that are spending their time watching and listening to us will come back and tell us. Every week I hear I get new stories about people watching our podcasts and listening to them. And I think I told you last week, somebody called this Healthcare Fraud Investigation 101, which was a great compliment to be given to us. So it's good. And as always, we appreciate everybody tuning in and spending their time watching and listening to us. And we'll keep putting this stuff, we'll be putting some more color to these as these cases progress and sentencings and seeing where they go. So as always, good seeing you guys. And as always, thanks everybody for joining us. And again, you can get our newsletter. You can get these podcasts. Just go to the website, sign up for the newsletter every Friday. It'll come right to your inbox, LinkedIn. We release these podcasts on Thursdays on LinkedIn. We'll see you guys all on the next OIG Roundtable. Thanks for tuning in, everybody. Take care.
Thank you. You all.